man with a big shadow, snarling in the midst of all. Snarling? An amiable fellow like me? Tyrion was almost flattered. And no doubt that is just what he intends. Every fool loves to hear that is important. Perhaps it was Penny you saw. We're almost of a size. No, my friend. My friend? When did that happen, I wonder? Did you see how long it will take us to reach Meereen? You are eager to behold the world's deliverer. Yes and no. The world's deliverer may snick off my head or give me to our dragons as a savory. Not me, said Tyrion. For me, it is all about the olives, though I fear I may grow old and die before I taste one. I could dog-paddle faster than we're sailing. Tell me, was Celis or Coran a triarch or a turtle? The Red Priest chuckled.
Neither. Coran is not a ruler, but one who serves and counsels such, and helps conduct his business. You of Westeros might say Stuart, or Magister.
King's Hand. That amused him. And Celisori? Macoro touched his nose.
Imbued with a pleasant aroma. Fragrant, would you say? Flowery.
So Celisori, Coran, means stinky Stuart, more or less.
A fragrant Stuart, rather.
Tyrion gave a crooked grin. I believe I will stay with Stinky, but I do thank you for the lesson.
I am pleased to have enlightened you. Perhaps some day you will let me teach you the truth of R'hllor as well.
Some day, when I'm ahead on a spike. The quarters he shared with Ser Jorah were a cabin only by courtesy. The dank, dark, foul-smelling closet had barely enough space to hang a pair of sleeping hammocks, one above the other. He found Mormont stretched out in the lower one, swaying slowly with the motion of the ship. The girl finally poked her nose above decks, Tyrion told him. One look at me and she scurried right back down below.
You're not a pretty sight.
Not all of us can be as comely as you. The girl is lost. It would not surprise me if the poor creature wasn't sneaking up to jump over the side and drown herself. The poor creature's name is Penny. I know her name. He hated her name. Her brother had gone by the name of Groat, though his true name had been Oppo. Groat and Penny, the smallest coins worth the least. And what's worse, they chose the names themselves. It left a bad taste in Tyrion's mouth. By any name, she needs a friend. Ser Jorah sat up in his hammock.
Befriend her, then. Marry her, for all I care.
That left a bad taste in his mouth as well. Like with like. Is that your notion? Or do you mean to find a she-bear for yourself, sir? You were the one who insisted that we bring her. I said we could not abandon her in Volantis. That does not mean I want to fuck her. She wants me dead. Have you forgotten? I'm the last person she's like to want as a friend.
You're both dwarfs?
Yes, and so was her brother, who was killed because some drunken fools took him for me.
Feeling guilty, are you?
No, Tyrion bristled. I have sins enough to answer for. I'll have no part of this one. I might have nurtured some ill will toward her, and her brother, for the part they played the night of Joffrey's wedding, but I never wished them harm. You are a harmless creature, to be sure. Innocent as a lamb. Ser Jorah got to his feet. The dwarf girl is your burden. Kiss her, kill her, or avoid her, as you like. It's naught to me. He shouldered past Tyrion and out of the cabin. Twice exiled, and small wonder, Tyrion thought. I'd exile him too if I could. The man is cold, brooding, sullen, deaf to humour. And those are his good points.
Sir Jorah spent most of his waking hours pacing the forecastle, or leaning on the rail, gazing out to sea.
Looking for his Silver Queen, looking for Daenerys, willing the ship to sail faster.
Well, I might do the same, if Tysha waited in Meereen.
Could Slaver's Bay be where Hawes went? It seemed unlikely. From what he'd read, the slaver cities were the place where Hawes were made.
Mormont should have brought one for himself.
A pretty slave girl might have done wonders to improve his temper, particularly one with silvery hair, like the whore who'd been sitting on his cock back in Silhoris. On the river, Tyrion had to endure Griff, but there had at least been the mystery of the captain's true identity to divert him, and the more congenial companionship of the rest of the pole boat's little company. On the cog, alas, everyone was just who they appeared to be. No one was particularly congenial, and only the Red Priest was interesting.
Him and maybe Penny, but the girl hates me, and she should.
Life aboard the Selous Orichorin was nothing if not tedious, Tyrion had found. The most exciting part of his day was pricking his toes and fingers with a knife. On the river there had been wonders to behold. Giant turtles, ruined cities, stone men, naked scepters. One never knew what might be lurking around the next bend. The days and nights at sea were all the same. Leaving Volantis, the cog had sailed within sight of land at first, so Tyrion could gaze at passing headlands, watch clouds of seabirds rise from stony cliffs and crumbling watchtowers, count bare brown islands as they slipped past. He saw many other ships as well, fishing boats, lumbering merchantmen, proud galleys with their oars lashing the waves into white foam. But once they struck out into deeper waters, there was only sea and sky, air and water. The water looked like water. The sky looked like sky. Sometimes there was a cloud. Too much blue. And the nights were worse. Tyrion slept badly at the best of times, and this was far from that. Sleep meant dreams, as like as not, and in his dreams the sorrows waited. And a stony king with his father's face. That left him with a beggar's choice of climbing up into his hammock and listening to Jorah Mormont snore beneath him, or remaining above decks to contemplate the sea. On moonless nights, the water was as black as maester's ink, from horizon to horizon, dark and deep and forbidding, beautiful in a chilly sort of way. But when he looked at it too long, Tyrion found himself musing on how easy it would be to slip over the gunwale and drop down into that darkness. One very small splash, and the pathetic little tale that was his life would soon be done.
But what if there is a hell, and my father's waiting for me?
The best part of each evening was supper. The food was not especially good, but it was plentiful, so that was where the dwarf went next. The galley where he took his meals was a cramped and uncomfortable space, with a ceiling so low that the taller passengers were always in danger of cracking their heads, a hazard the strapping slave soldiers of the Fiery Hand seemed particularly prone to. As much as Tyrion enjoyed sniggering at that, he had come to prefer taking his meals alone. Sitting at a crowded table with men who did not share a common language with you, listening to them talk and jape whilst understanding none of it, had quickly grown wearisome. Particularly since he always found himself wondering if the japes and laughter were directed at him. The galley was also where the ship's books were kept. Her captain being an especially bookish man, she carried three. A collection of nautical poetry that went from bad to worse, a well-thumbed tome about the erotic adventures of a young slave girl in a Lycian pillow house, and the fourth and final volume of The Life of the Triarch Belicho, a famous Volantine patriot whose unbroken succession of conquests and triumphs ended rather abruptly when he was eaten by giants. Tyrion had finished them all by their third day at sea. Then, for lack of any other books, he started reading them again. The slave girl's story was the worst written, but the most engrossing. And that was the one he took down this evening to see him through a supper of buttered beets, cold fish stew, and biscuits that could have been used to drive nails. He was reading the girl's account of the day she and her sister were taken by slavers when Penny entered the gallery.
"Oh," she said, "I thought I did not mean to disturb, my lord.
You're not disturbing me. You're not going to try to kill me again, I hope?"
"No."
She looked away, her face reddening. "In that case, I would welcome some company. There's little enough aboard this ship." Tyrion closed the book. "Come, sit, eat." The girl had left most of her meals untouched outside her cabin door. By now she must be starving. "The stew is almost edible. The fish is fresh, at least."
"No, I choked on a fishbone once. I can't eat fish."
"Have some wine, then." He filled a cup and slid it toward her. "Compliments of our captain. Closer to piss than Arbor Gold, if truth be told. But even piss tastes better than the black tar rum the sailors drink. It might help you sleep." The girl made no move to touch the cup.
"Thank you, my lord, but no."
She backed away.
"I should not be bothering you."
"Do you mean to spend your whole life running away?" Tyrion asked, before she could slip back out the door. That stopped her. Her cheeks turned a bright pink, and he was afraid she was about to start weeping again. Instead, she thrust out her lip defiantly and said,
"You're running too."
"I am," he confessed, "but I'm running too, and you are running from. And there's a world of difference there."
"We would never have had to run at all but for you."
"It took some courage to say that to my face."
"Are you speaking of King's Landing or Volantis?"
"Both."
Tears glistened in her eyes.
"Everything. Why couldn't you just come joust with us the way the king wanted? You wouldn't have gotten hurt. What would that have cost, my lord, to climb up on our dog and ride a tilt to please the boy? It was just a bit of fun. They would have laughed at you, that's all."
"They would have laughed at me," said Tyrion. "I made them laugh at Joff instead. And wasn't that a clever ploy?"
"My brother says that is a good thing, making people laugh, a noble thing, an honourable. My brother says he—"
The tears fell then, rolling down her face. "I am sorry about your brother." Tyrion had said the same words to her before, back in Volantis, but she was so far gone in grief back there that he doubted she had heard them. She heard them now.
"Sorry? You are sorry?"
Her lip was trembling, her cheeks were wet, her eyes were red-rimmed holes.
"We left King's Landing that very night. My brother said it was for the best, before someone wondered if we'd had some part in the king's death, and decided to torture us to find out. We went to Tyrosh first. My brother thought that would be far enough, but it wasn't. We knew a juggler there. For years and years he would juggle every day by the fountain of the drunken god. He was old, so his hands were not as deft as they had been, and sometimes he would drop his balls and chase them across the square. But the Tyroshi would laugh and throw him coins all the same. But one morning we heard that his body had been found at the Temple of Trios. Trios has three heads, and there's a big statue of him beside the temple doors. The old man had been cut into three parts and pushed inside the threefold mouths of Trios. Only when the parts were sewn back together, his head was gone.
A gift for my sweet sister. He was another dwarf.
A little man, aye, like you. An Uppo, Groat. Are you sorry about the juggler, too?
I never knew your juggler existed until this very moment.
But yes,
I am sorry he is dead.
He died for you. His blood is on your hands.
The accusation stung, coming so hard on the heels of Jorah Mormont's words. His blood is on my sister's hands, and the hands of the brutes who killed him. My hands. Tyrion turned them over, inspected them, coiled them into fists. My hands are crusted with old blood. I call me Kinslayer, and you won't be wrong. Kingslayer, I'll answer to that one as well. I have killed mothers, fathers, nephews, lovers, men and women, kings and whores. A singer once annoyed me, so I had the bastard stewed. But I have never killed a juggler, nor a dwarf, and I am not to blame for what happened to your bloody brother. Penny picked up the cup of wine he'd poured for her and threw it in his face. Just like my sweet sister. He heard the galley door slam, but never saw her leave. His eyes were stinging, and the world was a blur. So much for befriending her. Tyrion Lannister had scant experience with other dwarfs. His lord father had not welcomed any reminders of his son's deformities, and such mummers as featured little folk in their troops soon learned to stay away from Lannisport and Castle Rock, at the risk of his displeasure. Growing up, Tyrion heard reports of a dwarf jester at the seat of the Dornish Lord Fowler, a dwarf maester in service on the Fingers, and a female dwarf amongst the Silent Sisters, but he never felt the least need to seek them out. Less reliable tales also reached his ears of a dwarf witch who haunted a hill in the Riverlands, and a dwarf whore in King's Landing, renowned for coupling with dogs. His own sweet sister had told him of the last, even offering to find him a bitch in heat, if he cared to try it out. When he asked politely if she were referring to herself, Cersei had thrown a cup of wine in his face. "That was red, as I recall, and this is gold." Tyrion mopped his face with a sleeve. His eyes still stung. He did not see Penny again until the day of the storm. The salt air lay still and heavy that morning, but the western sky was a fiery red, streaked with lowering clouds that glowed as bright as Lannister crimson. Sailors were dashing about, battening hatches, running lines, clearing the decks, lashing down everything that was not already lashed down.
"Bad wind coming," one warned him. "No nose should get below."
Tyrion remembered the storm he'd suffered, crossing the narrow sea, the way the deck had jumped beneath his feet, the hideous creaking sounds the ship had made, the taste of wine and vomit. "No nose will stay up here." If the guards wanted him, he would sooner die by drowning than choking on his own vomit. And overhead, the cog's canvas sail rippled slowly, like the fur of some great beast stirring from a long sleep, then filled with a sudden crack that turned every head on the ship. The winds drove the cog before them, far off her chosen course. Behind them, black clouds piled one atop another against a blood-red sky. By mid-morning, they could see lightning flickering to the west, followed by the distant crash of thunder. The sea grew rougher, and dark waves rose up to smash against the hull of the Stinky Steward. It was about then that the crew started hauling down the canvas. Tyrion was underfoot, amidships, so he climbed the forecastle and hunkered down, savouring the lash of cold rain on his cheeks. The cog went up and down, bucking more wildly than any horse he'd ever ridden, lifting with each wave before sliding down into the troughs between, jarring him to the bones. Even so, it was better here, where he could see, than down below, locked in some airless cabin. By the time the storm broke, evening was upon them, and Tyrion Lannister was soaked through to the small clothes, yet somehow he felt elated, and even more so later, when he found a drunken Jorah Mormont in a pool of vomit in their cabin. The dwarf lingered in the galley after supper, celebrating his survival by sharing a few tots of black tar rum with the ship's cook, a great, greasy, loutish volantine who spoke only one word of the common tongue, fuck, but played a ferocious game of Sivas, particularly when drunk. They played three games at night. Tyrion won the first, then lost the other two. After that he decided that he'd had enough, and stumbled back up on deck to clear his head of rum and elephants alike. He found Penny on the forecastle, where he had so often found Ser Jorah, standing by the rail beside the cog's hideous, half-rotted figurehead, and gazing out across the inky sea. From behind, she looked as small and vulnerable as a child. Tyrion thought it best to leave her undisturbed, but it was too late. She had heard him. "Hugo Hill?" "If you like. We both know better. I am sorry to intrude on you. I will retire." "No." Her face was pale and sad, but she did not look to have been crying. "I'm sorry, too, about the wine. It wasn't you who killed my brother, or that poor old man in Tyrosh."
"I played a part, though not by choice."
"I miss him so much. My brother, I
understand." He found himself thinking of Jamie. "Count yourself lucky. Your brother died before he could betray you."
"I thought I wanted to die," she said, "but today, when the storm came and I thought the ship would sink, I...
"You realized that you wanted to live after all?" "I have been there, too." "Something else we have in common." Her teeth were crooked, which made her shy with her smiles, but she smiled now.
"Did you truly cook a singer in the stew?"
"Who, me? No, I do not cook."
When Penny giggled, she sounded like the sweet young girl she was, 17, 18, no more than 19.
"What did he do, this singer?"
"He wrote a song about me."
"For she was his secret treasure, she was his shame and his bliss, and a chain and a keep are nothing compared to a woman's kiss."
It was queer how quick the words came back to him. Perhaps they had never left him.
"Hands of gold are always cold, but a woman's hands are warm."
"It must have been a very bad song."
"Not really. It was no Rains of Castamere, mind you. But some parts were, well..."
"How did it go?"
He laughed. "No, you do not want to hear me sing."
"My mother used to sing to us when we were children, my brother and me. She always said that it didn't matter what your voice was like, so long as you loved the song."
"Was she
a little person?" "No, but our father was. His own father sold him to a slaver when he was free. But he grew up to be such a famous mummer that he bought his freedom. He travelled to all the free cities and Westeros as well. In Old Town, they used to call him Hopbean."
"Of course they did." Tyrion tried not to wince.
"He's dead now," Penny went on. "My mother, too. Uppo, he was my last family. And now he's gone, too."
She turned her head away and gazed out across the sea.
"What will I do? Where will I go? I have no trade, just the jousting show. And that needs two."
"No," thought Tyrion, "that is not a place you want to go, girl. Do not ask that of me. Do not even think it." "Find yourself some likely orphan boy," he suggested. Penny did not seem to hear that.
"It was my father's idea to do the tilts. He even trained the first pig. But by then he was too sick to ride her, so Uppo took his place. I always rode the dog. We performed for the Sea Lord of Bravos once, and he laughed so hard that afterwards he gave each of us a grand gift."
"Is that where my sister found you? In Bravos?"
"Your sister?"
The girl looked lost. "Queen Cersei." Penny shook her head.
"She never. It was a man who came to us in Pentos. Osmond, no, Oswald, something like that. Uppo met with him, not me. Uppo made all of our arrangements. My brother always knew what to do, where we should go next."
"Meereen is where we're going next."
She gave him a puzzled look. "Carth, you mean? We're bound for Carth, by way of New Giss."
"Meereen, you'll ride your dog for the Dragon Queen and come away with your weight in gold. Best start eating more, so you'll be nice and plump when you joust before her grace." Penny did not return the smile.
"By myself, all I can do is ride around in circles. And even if the Queen should laugh, where will I go afterwards? We never stay in one place long. The first time they see us, they laugh and laugh, but by the fourth or fifth time, they know what we're going to do before we do it. Then they stop laughing, so we have to go somewhere new. We make the most coin in the big cities, but I always like the little towns the best. Places like that, the people have no silver, but they feed us at their own tables, and the children follow us everywhere."
"That's because they've never seen a dwarf before in their wretched pisspot towns," Tyrion thought. "The bloody brats would follow around a two-headed goat if one turned up, until they got bored with its bleating and slaughtered it for supper." But he had no wish to make her weep again, so instead he said, "Daenerys has a kind heart and a generous nature." It was what she needed to hear. "She will find a place for you at her court, I don't doubt. A safe place, beyond my sister's reach." Penny turned back to him.
"And you will be there too?"
"Unless Daenerys decides she needs some Lannister blood to pay for the Targaryen blood my brother shed. I will." After that, the dwarf girl was seen more frequently above deck. The next day, Tyrion encountered her and her spotted sow amidships in mid-afternoon, when the air was warm and the sea calm.
"Her name is Pretty,"
the girl told him shyly. "Pretty the pig and Penny the girl," he thought. "Someone has a deal to answer for." Penny gave Tyrion some acorns, and he let Pretty eat them from his hand. "Do not think I don't see what you're doing, girl," he thought, as the big sow snuffled and squealed. Soon they began to take their meals together. Some nights it was just the two of them. At other meals they crowded in with Macoro's guards. "The Fingers," Tyrion called them. They were men of the Fiery Hand, after all. And there were five of them. Penny laughed at that, a sweet sound, though not one he heard often. Her wound was too fresh, her grief too deep. He soon had her calling the ship the Stinky Steward, though she got somewhat wroth with him whenever he called Pretty Bacon. To return for that, Tyrion made an attempt to teach her Syvas, though he soon realized that was a lost cause. "No," he said a dozen times, "the dragonflies, not the elephants." That same night she came right out and asked him if he would like to tilt with her. "No," he answered. Only later did it occur to him that perhaps tilt did not mean tilt. His answer would still have been no, but he might not have been so brusque. Back in the cabin he shared with Jorah Mormont, Tyrion twisted in his hammock for hours, slipping in and out of sleep. His dreams were full of grey, stony hands reaching for him from out of the fog, and a stair that led up to his father. Finally he gave it up and made his way up top for a breath of night air. The Selasori Coran had furled her big striped sail for the night, and her decks were all but deserted. One of the mates was on the stern castle, and amidships Makoro sat by his brazier, where a few small flames still danced amongst the embers. Only the brightest stars were visible, all to the west. A dull red glow lit the sky to the northeast, the colour of a blood bruise. Tyrion had never seen a bigger moon, monstrous, swollen. It looked as if it had swallowed the sun and woken with a fever. Its twin, floating on the sea beyond the ship, shimmered red with every wave. "What hour is this?" he asked Makoro. "That cannot be sunrise, unless the east has moved. Why is the sky red?"
"The sky is always red above Valyria, Hugo Hill."
A cold chill went down his back.
"Are we close?"
"Closer than the crew would like,"
Makoro said in his deep voice.
"Do you know the stories in your sunset kingdoms?"
"I know some sailors say that any man who lays eyes upon that coast is doomed."
He did not believe such tales himself, no more than his uncle had. Jerry and Lannister had set sail for Valyria when Tyrion was 18, intent on recovering the lost ancestral blade of House Lannister and any other treasures that might have survived the doom. Tyrion had wanted desperately to go with them, but his lord father had dubbed the voyage a fool's quest and forbidden him to take part.
And perhaps he was not so wrong. Almost a decade had passed since the Laughing Lion headed out from Lannisport, and Geryon had never returned. The men Lord Tywin sent to seek after him had traced his course as far as Valentus, where half his crew had deserted him, and he had bought slaves to replace them. No free man would willingly sign aboard a ship whose captain spoke openly of his intent to sail into the Smoking Sea. So those are fires of the 14 flames we're seeing, reflected on the clouds.
14 or 14,000, what man dares count them? It is not wise for mortals to look too deeply at those fires, my friend. Those are fires of God's own wrath, and no human flame can match them. We are small creatures, men.
Some smaller than others.
Valyria. It was written that on the day of doom every hill for 500 miles had split asunder, to fill the air with ash and smoke and fire, blazes so hot and hungry that even the dragons in the sky were engulfed and consumed. Great rents had opened in the earth, swallowing palaces, temples, entire towns. Lakes boiled or turned to acid. Mountains burst. Fiery fountains spewed molten rock 1,000 feet into the air. Red clouds rained down dragon glass and the black blood of demons. And to the north the ground splintered and collapsed and fell in on itself, and an angry sea came rushing in. The proudest city in all the world was gone in an instant. Its fabled empire vanished in a day. The lands of the long summer scorched and drowned and blighted. An empire built on blood and fire. The Valyrians reap the seed they had sown.
Does our captain mean to test the curse?
Our captain would prefer to be 50 leagues further out to sea, well away from that accursed shore. But I have commanded him to steer the shortest course. Others seek Daenerys too.
Griff with his young prince. Could all that talk of the Golden Company sailing west have been a feint? Tyrion considered saying something, then thought better. It seemed to him that the prophecy that drove the Red Priests had room for just one hero. A second Targaryen would only serve to confuse them.
"Have you seen these others in your fires?" he asked wearily. "Only their shadows," Mokoro said. "One most of all, a tall and twisted thing with one black eye and 10 long arms, sailing on a sea of blood."
Bran. The moon was a crescent, thin and sharp as a blade of a knife. A pale sun rose, and set, and rose again. Red leaves whispered in the wind. Dark clouds filled the skies and turned to storms. Lightning flashed, and thunder rumbled, and dead men with black hands and bright blue eyes shuffled round a cleft in the hillside, but could not enter. Under the hill, the broken boy sat upon a weirwood throne, listening to whispers in the dark, as ravens walked up and down his arms. "You will never walk again," the three-eyed crow had promised, "but you will fly." Sometimes a sound of song would drift up from some place far below. The children of the forest, old Nan would have called the singers, but those who sing the song of earth was their own name for themselves, in the true tongue that no human could speak. The ravens could speak it, though. Their small black eyes were full of secrets, and they would caw at him and peck his skin when they heard the songs. The moon was fat and full. Stars wheeled across a black sky. Rain fell and froze, and tree limbs snapped from the weight of the ice. Bran and Mira made up names for those who sang the song of earth. Ash and leaf and scales. Black knife and snowy locks and coals. Their true names were too long for human tongues, said Leif. Only she could speak the common tongue, so what the others thought of their new names, Bran never learned. After the bone-grinding cold of the lands beyond the wall, the caves were blessedly warm, and when the chill crept out of the rock, the singers would light fires to drive it off again. Down here there was no wind, no snow, no ice, no dead things reaching out to grab you, only dreams and rushlight, and the kisses of the ravens, and the whisperer in darkness. The last green seer, the singers called him, but in Bran's dreams he was still a three-eyed crow. When Mira Reed had asked him his true name, he made a ghastly sound that might have been a chuckle.
"I wore many names when I was quick, but even I once had a mother, and the name she gave me at her breast was Brendan."
"I have an uncle Brendan," Bran said. "He's my mother's uncle, really. Brendan Blackfist, he's called."
"Your uncle may have been named for me. Some are still. Not so many as before. Men forget. Only the trees remember."
His voice was so soft that Brendan had to strain to hear.
"Most of him has gone into the tree," explained the singer Miracle Leaf. "He has lived beyond his mortal span, and yet he lingers. For us, for you, for the realms of men. Only a little strength remains in his flesh. He has 1,000 eyes and one, but there is much to watch. One day you will know."
"What will I know?"
Bran asked the reeds afterward, when they came with torches burning brightly in their hand, to carry him back to a small chamber off the big cavern, where the singers had made beds for them to sleep.
"What do the trees remember?" "The secrets of the old gods," said Jojen Reed.
Food and fire and rest had helped restore him after the ordeals of their journey, but he seemed sadder now, sullen, with a weary, haunted look about the eyes.
"Truth the first man knew, forgotten now in Winterfell, but not in the wet wild. We live closer to the green in our bogs and crannocks, and we remember. Earth and water, soil and stone, oaks and elms and willows, they were here before us all, and will still remain when we are gone."
"So will you," said Mira. That made Bran sad.
"What if I don't want to remain when you are gone?" he almost asked,
but he swallowed the words unspoken. He was almost a man grown, and he did not want Mira to think he was some weepy babe.
"Maybe you could be Green Seers, too," he said instead.
"No, Bran." Now Mira sounded sad.
"It is given to a few to drink of that green fountain while still in mortal flesh, to hear the whisperings of the leaves and see as the trees see, as the gods see," said Jojen. "Most are not so blessed. The gods gave me only green dreams. My task was to get you here. My part in this is done."
The moon was a black hole in the sky. Wolves howled in the wood, sniffing through the snowdrifts after dead things. A murder of ravens erupted from the hillside, screaming their sharp cries, black wings beating above a white world. A red sun rose and set and rose again, painting the snows in shades of rose and pink. Onto the hill, Jojen brooded. Mira fretted, and Hodor wandered through dark tunnels with a sword in his right hand and a torch in his left. Or was it Bran wandering?
No one must ever know.
The great cavern that opened on the abyss was as black as pitch, black as tar, blacker than the feathers of a crow. Light entered as a trespasser, unwanted and unwelcome, and soon was gone again. Cook fires, candles, and rushes burned for a little while, then gutted out again, their brief lives at an end. The singers made Bran a throne of his own, like the one Lord Brynden sat, white weirwood flecked with red, dead branches woven through living roots. They placed it in the great cavern by the abyss, where the black air echoed to the sound of running water far below. Of soft grey moss they made his seat. Once he had been lowered into place, they covered him with warm furs. There he sat, listening to the hoarse whispers of his teacher.
"Never fear the darkness, Bran."
The Lord's words were accompanied by a faint rustling of wood and leaf, a slight twisting of his head.
"The strongest trees are rooted in the dark places of the earth. Darkness will be your cloak, your shield, your mother's milk. Darkness will make you strong."
The moon was a crescent, thin and sharp as the blade of a knife. Snowflakes drifted down soundlessly to cloak the soldier pines and sentinels in white. The drifts grew so deep that they covered the entrance to the caves, leaving a white wall that Summer had to dig through whenever he went outside to join his pack and hunt. Bran did not oft range with them in those days, but some nights he watched them from above. Flying was even better than climbing. Slipping into Summer's skin had become as easy for him as slipping on a pair of breeches once had been, before his back was broken. Changing his own skin for a raven's night black feathers had been harder, but not as hard as he had feared. Not with these ravens.
"A wild stallion will buck and kick when a man tries to mount him, and try to bite the hand that slips the bit between his teeth," Lord Brynden said. "But a horse that has known one rider will accept another. Young or old, these birds have all been ridden. Choose one now, and fly."
He chose one bird and then another, without success, but the third raven looked at him with shrewd black eyes, tilted its head, and gave a quack, and quick as that, he was not a boy looking at a raven, but a raven looking at a boy. The song of the river suddenly grew louder. The torches burned a little brighter than before, and the air was full of strange smells. When he tried to speak, it came out in a scream, and his first flight ended when he crashed into a wall and ended back inside his own broken body. The raven was unhurt. It flew to him and landed on his arm, and Bran stroked its feathers and slipped inside of it again. Before long he was flying around the cavern, weaving through the long stone teeth
that hung down from the ceiling, even flapping out over the abyss and swooping down into its coal-black depths. Then he realized he was not alone.
"Someone else was in the Raven," he told Lord Brynden,
once he had returned to his own skin.
"Some girl. I felt her."
"A woman of those who sing the song of earth," his teacher said.
"Long dead, yet a part of her remains, just as a part of you would remain in summer if your boy's flesh were to die upon the morrow. A shadow on the soul. She will not harm you."
"Do all the birds have singers in them?"
"All," Lord Brynden said.
"It was the singers who taught the first men to send messages by raven. But in those days, the birds would speak the words. The trees remember, but men forget. And so now they write the messages on parchment and tie them round the feet of birds who have never shared their skin."
Old Nan had told him the same story once, Bran remembered. But when he asked Rob if it was true, his brother laughed and asked him if he believed in grumpkins too. He wished Rob were with them now.
"I tell him I could fly, but he wouldn't believe, so I'd have to show him. I'll bet that he could learn to fly too, him and Arya and Sansa, even baby Rickon and Jon Snow. We could all be ravens and live in Maester Luwin's rookery."
That was just another silly dream, though. Some days Bran wondered if all of this wasn't just some dream. Maybe he had fallen asleep out in the snows and dreamed himself a safe, warm place.
"You have to wake,"
he would tell himself.
"You have to wake right now, or you'll go dreaming into death."
Once or twice he pinched his arm with his fingers, really hard, but the only thing that did was make his arm hurt. In the beginning he had tried to count the days by making note of when he woke and slept, but down here, sleeping and waking had a way of melting into one another. Dreams became lessons. Lessons became dreams. Things happened all at once, or not at all. Had he done that, or only dreamed it?
"Only one man in a thousand is born a skin-changer,"
Lord Brynden said one day, after Bran had learned to fly.
"And only one skin-changer in a thousand can be a greenseer." "I thought the greenseers were the wizards of the children," Bran said. "The singers, I mean."
"In a sense, those you call the children of the forest have eyes as golden as the sun, but once in a great while one is born amongst them with eyes as red as blood, or green as the moss on a tree in the heart of the forest. By these signs do the gods mark those they have chosen to receive the gift. The chosen ones are not robust, and their quick years upon the earth are few, for every song must have its balance. But once inside the wood, they linger long indeed. A thousand eyes, a hundred skins, wisdom deep as the roots of ancient trees. Green seers."
Bran did not understand, so he asked the reeds.
"Do you like to read books, Bran?"
Jojen asked him.
"Some books. I like the fighting stories. My sister Sansa likes the kissing stories, but those are stupid." "A reed lives a thousand days before he dies," said Jojen. "The man who never reads lives only one. The singers of the forest had no books. No ink, no parchment, no written language. Instead, they had the trees, and the weirwoods above all. When they died, they went into the wood, into leaf, limb and root, and the trees remembered. All their songs and spells, their histories and prayers, everything they knew about this world. Maesters will tell you that the weirwoods are sacred to the old gods. The singers believed they are the old gods. When singers die, they become part of that godhood."
Bran's eyes widened.
"They're gonna kill me."
"No," Mary said. "Jojen, you're scaring him. He is not the one who needs to be afraid."
The moon was fat and full. Summer prowled through the silent woods
a long grey shadow that grew more gaunt with every hunt, for living game could not be found. The ward upon the cave mouth still held. The dead men could not enter. The snows had buried most of them again, but they were still there, hidden, frozen, waiting. Other dead things came to join them, things that had once been men and women, even children. Dead ravens sat on bare brown branches, wings crusted with ice. A snow bear crashed through the brush, huge and skeletal, half its head sloughed away to reveal the skull beneath. Summer and his pack fell upon it and tore it into pieces. Afterwards they gorged, though the meat was rotted and half-frozen, and moved even as they ate it. Under the hill they still had food to eat. 100 kinds of mushrooms grew down there. Blind whitefish swam in the Black River, but they tasted just as good as fish with eyes once you cooked them up. They had cheese and milk from the goats that shared the caves with the singers, even some oats and barleycorn and dried fruit laid by during the long summer. And almost every day they ate blood stew, thickened with barley and onions and chunks of meat. Jojen thought it might be squirrel meat, and Mira said it was rat. Bran did not care. It was meat, and it was good. The stewing made it tender. The caves were timeless, vast, silent. They were home to more than 70 living singers and the bones of thousands dead, and extended far below the hollow hill.
"Men should not go wandering in this place," Leif warned them. "The river ye hear is swift and black, and flows down and down to a sunless sea. And there are passages that go even deeper, bottomless pits, and sudden shafts, forgotten ways that lead to the very centre of the earth. Even my people have not explored them all, and we have lived here for 1,000,000 of your man-years."
Though the men of the 7 kingdoms might call them the children of the forest, Leif and her people were far from childlike. Little wise men of the forest would have been closer. They were small compared to men, as a wolf is smaller than a dire-wolf. That does not mean it is a pup. They had not brown skin, dappled like a deer's with paler spots, and large ears that could hear things that no man could hear. Their eyes were big, too, great golden cat's eyes that could see down passages where a boy's eyes saw only blackness. Their hands had only 3 fingers and a thumb, with sharp black claws instead of nails. And they did sing. They sang in true tongue, so Bran could not understand the words. But their voices were as pure as winter air.
"Where are the rest of you?" Bran asked Leif once. "Gone down into the earth," she answered. "Into the stones, into the trees. Before the first men came, all this land that you call Westeros was home to us. Yet even in those days we were few. The gods gave us long lives, but not great numbers, lest we overrun the world, as deer will overrun a wood, where there are no wolves to hunt them. That was in the dawn of days, when our sun was rising. Now it sinks, and this is our long dwindling. The giants are almost gone as well, they who were our bane and our brothers. The great lions of the western hills have been slain. The unicorns are all but gone, the mammoths down to a few hundred. The direwolves will outlast us all, but their time will come as well. In the world that men have made, there is no room for them, or us."
She seemed sad when she said it, and that made Bran sad as well. It was only later that he thought,
"Men would not be sad. Men would be wroth. Men would hate and swear a bloody vengeance. The singers sing sad songs, where men would fight and kill."
One day Mira and Jojen decided to go see the river, despite Leif's cautions.
"I want to come too," Bran said.
Mira gave him a mournful look. The river was 600 feet below, down steep slopes and twisty passages, she explained. and the last part required climbing down a rope.
Hodor can never make the claim with you on his back. I'm sorry, Bran.
Bran remembered a time when no one could climb as good as him, not even Rob or John. Part of him wanted to shout at them for leaving him. Another part wanted to cry. He was almost a man grown, though, so he said nothing. But after they were gone, he slipped inside Hodor's skin and followed them. The big stable boy no longer fought him, as he had the first time back in the Lake Tower during the storm. Like a dog who has had all the fight whipped out of him, Hodor would curl up and hide whenever Bran reached out for him. His hiding place was somewhere deep within him, a pit where not even Bran could touch him.
"No one wants to hurt you, Hodor," he said silently to the child man whose flesh he'd taken. "I just want to be strong again for a while. I'll give it back, the way I always do."
No one ever knew when he was wearing Hodor's skin. Bran only had to smile, do as he was told, and mutter, "Hodor," from time to time, and he could follow Mira and Jojen grinning happily without anyone suspecting it was really him. He often tagged along, whether he was wanted or not. In the end, the reeds were glad he came. Jojen made it down the rope easily enough, but after Mira caught a blind white fish with her frog spear, and it was time to climb back up, his arms began to tremble, and he could not make it to the top. So he had to tie the rope around him and let Hodor hold him up.
"Hodor," he grunted every time he gave a pull. "Hodor, Hodor, Hodor."
The moon was a crescent, thin and sharp as a blade of a knife. Summer dug up a severed arm, black and covered with hoarfrost, its fingers opening and closing as it pulled itself across the frozen snow. There was still enough meat on it to fill his empty belly, and after that was done, he cracked the arm bones for the marrow. Only then did the arm remember it was dead. Bran ate with Summer and his pack as a wolf. As a raven, he flew with the murder, circling the hill at sunset, watching for foes, feeling the icy touch of the air. As Hodor, he explored the caves. He found chambers full of bones, shafts that plunged deep into the earth, a place where the skeletons of gigantic bats hung upside down from the ceiling. He even crossed the slender stone bridge that arched over the abyss, and discovered more passages and chambers on the far side. One was full of singers, enthroned like Brynden in nests of weirwood roots that weaved under and through and around their bodies. Most of them looked dead to him, but as he crossed in front of them, their eyes would open and follow the light of his torch, and one of them opened and closed a wrinkled mouth as if he were trying to speak. "Hodor," Bran said to him, and he felt the real Hodor stir down in his pit. Seated on his throne of roots in the great cavern, half corpse and half tree, Lord Brynden seemed less a man than some ghastly statue made of twisted wood, old bone, and rotted wool. The only thing that looked alive in the pale ruin that was his face was his one red eye, burning like the last coal in a dead fire. Surrounded by twisted roots and tatters of leathery white skin hanging off a yellowed skull. The sight of him still frightened Bran. The weirwood roots snaking in and out of his withered flesh, the mushroom sprouting from his cheeks, the white wooden worm that grew from the socket where one eye had been. He liked it better when the torches were put out. In the dark, he could pretend that it was only the three-eyed crow who whispered to him, and not some grisly, talking corpse.
"One day I will be like him."
The thought filled Bran with dread. Bad enough that he was broken, with his useless legs. Was he doomed to lose the rest too, to spend the rest of his years with a weirwood growing in him and through him? Lord Brynden drew his life from the tree, Leif told him. He did not eat. He did not drink. He slept. He dreamt. He watched.
"I was going to be a knight,"
Bran remembered. I used to run and climb and fight. It seemed 1,000 years ago. What was he now? Only Bran.